please note this, that the church is not the most segregated institution in America. You've heard that line. 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. Not true. The most segregated institution in America are the bars. I had a friend that taught at the University of Pennsylvania who would just have his students to go around and visit bars and give the demographics of the bars. Are there such places as gay bars? Have you ever heard of gay bars? You're a gay person. You don't go to any bar. What do? You go to the gay bar. And everybody knows who they are and where they are. Are there bars where black people go? Are there Irish pubs? And St. Patrick's Day, it's coming up soon. They're going to run on television. They want to show people celebrating St. Patrick's Day. They'll go to an Irish bar. And here will all these guys, drunk as can be, for the Irish, And Irish bars, Italian bars. The only thing we don't have is Baptist bars. What a shame. Now, we do have Baptist bars, but the people don't admit that they're Baptist. They pretend they're Catholic. That's the way it is. So, when you begin to study a city, you begin to take note of these things. Did you ever pay much attention to the institution called the bars? And if you're running for office, you know which bars to go to and which bars not to go to. If you're a Republican, you don't go to the black bars. You could get beat up. E. Digby Boltzell. He became fascinated with the whole Philadelphia area, primarily because he was on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania. And he taught courses in what we call social stratification. How do upper-class people behave, middle-class people behave, lower-class people behave? What are the social patterns of social classes? This is very important. I'll deal with more of this in just a moment. And he became intrigued with the Philadelphia elite, because Philadelphia had an elite system unparalleled in America because of the oldness of the city. The Philadelphia establishment. But he never called it the Philadelphia establishment. Instead, he called it the Protestant establishment. And his book became a sociological classic. The Protestant establishment. And what he tries to do in that book is shows how a group of elitists, in this case, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, were able to gain control over the city and maintain control almost from its inception up until about 1965. What he found was among these elitists. You say, well, how do you become an elitist? Well, that's easy. You go to the right schools and you vacation in the right places. It's as simple as that. The right schools are all up and down the main line here. The Shipley School, the Haverford School, these are upper class schools. Incidentally, we have some upper middle class schools. The Baldwin School is upper middle class. Shipley is upper class.
Those are prep schools, though.
They are very much prep schools. They cost more than go to a university. These are very, very elite. And they make sure that it costs more than go to a university, because they don't want people who can't afford it. They don't want people who are poor to even try to get in. The one exception to all of this is Friends Central. Quaker school, you would expect that of the Quakers. They want diversity in their student body. I guarantee you, Shipley School is not working hard for diversity. They want the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant student. More so before 60 than now. It's beginning to break down, and I'll tell you, it's begun to break down. But this is the way it was. You went to the right schools. Not only that, but you went to the right universities when you graduated. If you graduated from Shipley or Haverford, what would be the desirable school to go to? Guess.
UPenn.
What's that?
UPenn.
Nah. Too middle class. Upper middle class. A lot of Jews at Penn. Have you been down there? A lot of Jews. There's even some black people there. Think of an Ivy school where you're going to send your kids.
Harvard.
What's that?
Harvard?
Not Harvard. My, Jews are all over the place. And what's more is Asians are coming in by the score. You know what happens at Harvard? They actually take academic standing into serious consideration. Don't all the Ivies? Yes. But there's one school where you need more than just the right credentials. You need the right recommendations from the right private schools. What school? Have you guessed it yet? You should be able to guess it. Yeah. Princeton. Princeton. Yale will also do, but not quite as much as Princeton. There is the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant institution. I mean, when, as a matter of fact, I am living now in a retirement center that has a lot of upper-class people in Bryn Mawr. You know what the biggest organization on camp in this retirement? The Princeton Club. All the Princeton grads who grew up on the main line, who retired to Beaumont, they get together and go Beulah, Beulah, and they're into their whole Princeton thing. Got it? Princeton. Now, there are also some other schools. Did you ever hear the term the Little Sisters? See, you're not elitist. You just don't know how the system works. The Little Sisters. There is a network of small schools that are elitist. Amherst, Williams, Wesleyan, Bryn Mawr. Bryn Mawr is breaking down, though. It's not so much on the undergraduate level, but on the graduate level. Do you begin to see you have these elitist schools? They're called the Little Sisters of Mount Holyoke, Wellesley. It's beginning to break down, but there was a time when to get into one of the Little Sister schools, if you weren't WASP, you were in real trouble. So you go to the right elementary schools and secondary schools. You go to the right university, but it's summer. So you vacation where? Guess. You can guess.
The Jersey Shore.
Oh, no way. That is so middle class. Tacky as can
be. Certain parts of the
show. Oh, yes. Even Surf City. Come on. It's middle class people.
Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard. That'll work. Martha, very good. Martha's Vineyard will work fine. All of Cape Cod will work fine. As a matter of fact, Long Island, out at the end of Long Island, that'll work fine. These become select vacation areas. So what happens is your kid grows up and goes to the school where the right children go, goes off to the university where the right people go, goes on vacation. I mean, you can, a fellow and a girl could meet and fall in love during vacation, right? But let's make sure they all the right people vacation in the right place, you see. You begin to see a pattern emerging here. As a matter of fact, sports are socially stratified. Lower class people bowl and go to see wrestling. Have you ever been to a wrestling match? You really need to go to a wrestling match. It is mind-boggling. I mean, it is, if you, that's what they play. Middle-class people play tennis. If you're upper-class, what do you play?
Squash.
Squash, very good. And what else?
Golf.
Now, let me tell you this. How do you become a member of a country club?
You have to have a sponsor.
You have to have a sponsor. You got it. You understand the name of the game, Sig. So country clubs became places where they could keep out, quote unquote, undesirables. They became bastions of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Incidentally, in order to shorten, not having to say this over again in the book, Baltzell coins a new word in the English language, WASP. He invented the word. I always love that because it was a colleague of mine at Penn. I say, what does it feel like to have invented a word for the English language? WASP. He invented the word. Incidentally, I invented a word, but it never worked. It was blumph. And I did it when I was at the University of Pennsylvania because I had 1,500 students in the class. And I said, you know, I'm not going to know your names. I couldn't put names on like this. I'm never going to know your names. and I'm going to meet you on the street. I mean, you're running 1,500 students through the introduction class every semester, and in addition to that, I'm teaching about 1,000 in the family class in the evenings. That's 2,500 kids a semester. In a given period of time, between, let's say, 1969 and 1974, anybody that went to school at Penn at that time probably had me for a course. And I meet these people on the street. You know, that's thousands and thousands of people. And I said, so I'm not going to know who you are. And you're going to be there with your mother, and it's going to be embarrassing. So just say, Dr. Campolo, blumph! And I'll say, oh, you were in my intro 100 class, 1,500 students. You were in my intro 100 class. And the mother's looking on so benevolently. Oh, my son was in this huge class, and the professor remembers him. So thousands and thousands of graduates of Penn knew the word blumph. I just got a note in the mail the other day. Guy says, you probably don't remember me, but I saw you in the Colbert Report the other night, and I really like what you had to say. And he signed his name, and he said, sincerely yours, blumph. I was on an airplane one day, and the stewardess comes, back in those days they called them stewardesses, comes down the aisle and looks at me and says, blumph, come on up to first class. And the guy next to me said, what was that all about? Says, it's a magic word. So the next time she came down the aisle, he said, blumph. Didn't work. It didn't work. What is it? It worked for him. It doesn't work for me. Be this as it may, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and these country clubs kept out people who weren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. You're doomed if you're not a white Protestant. It's a closed system. It's what we call a closed elite. And we begin to discriminate on this basis. E. Digby Boltzell believes in elites. He believes that the elite people of a society should rule the society. He thinks that multimillionaires ought to control the government and ought to be presidents. And here's the sociologist saying, you know, I know it sounds terrible that a man should be able to, that only rich people should become presidents, but stop to think of the alternative. Poor people run for president. The only way they can get the money to run the campaign is by becoming beholden to special interest groups. Would you rather have an elitist who is beholden to nobody than somebody who is sold out to special interest groups? You see how at first sight you're saying, this is terrible. The man's financing his own campaign. To which Boltzell would say, isn't that wonderful? He isn't sold out to anybody. Do you see how sociologists analyze things? They always see another side to it. They always see what we call the latent function. There's a good phrase, the latent function. The latent function. There's something going on here that nobody's noticing. And namely, the extreme power that he is able to exercise. Have you got it? Any questions at that point? So he believes in an elite. When he was at Penn, he always wanted to be on the admissions committee because he wanted to make sure that if any of the proper families had their children apply to Penn, even if they didn't measure up to some of the others, we ought to make room for them because we ought to make room for the elite. His problem was, and the whole book, The Protestant Establishment, deals with one group of people, the Jews, and how Jews are excluded from the system. And the reason why he picked the Jews is because people have all kinds of attitudes towards other ethnic groups. They will say about Italians, they're not as smart as everybody else. They say about blacks, well, you know, is there any question that Jews are smart? You may be anti-Semitic, but the one thing you're not going to question is their smarts. As a matter of fact, that's why there's so much fear of the Jews. They're so stinking smart. And so here are people who, by their personal traits, are obviously elitist. They are brilliant. Do they make good businessmen, good businesswomen? You bet they do. Are they able to function well in school? Of course they can. Do they make a lot of money? Yes, they do. So why keep them out? And what he points out is that the elitist system that existed along the main line of Philadelphia was an elitist system that kept out some of the most brilliant, some of the most successful, most of the most competent people in the Philadelphia area. They were kept out. And he says, if this goes on over a period of time, it's not going to be long before the establishment begins to disintegrate and becomes more and more inferior to what it was. And what is going to happen is that other groups will begin to emerge and create separate elites. And he saw it happening in Philadelphia. You know what the answer was? Not only were these Jews beginning to develop good businesses and making a lot of money, but they started their own country club. They started their own club in downtown Philadelphia. They started their own little establishment. And pretty soon, the establishment that was being created over here began to be threatening to the establishment that was over here. And so what he was calling for is society should be ruled by elites. But they should be, and if you read the book, open elites. They should be open to any ethnic group, any racial group, if the people can prove themselves deserving of the status. And incidentally, it's not just money that makes you upper class. Chris Rock, who I think is a brilliant sociology student, says there's two names for everything. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants, I don't know whether you've heard this line. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants are wealthy. Black people become rich. And he plays on that. Why is it that black people, when they have a lot of money, are called rich? And white people, when they have a lot of money, are wealthy. Do you see the stratification thing here? We're not just talking about how much money you have. As a matter of fact, we see a lot of people who become Nova rich, who become rich very quickly. But are they elitist? Did they go to the right schools? Do they have the right social credentials? Do they behave properly? Or are they loud Italians? Are they boisterous Jews? They just don't have the style. They don't dress right. I mean, if you go to the market here in Radnor Township, the farmer's market, on Thursday, Friday, have you ever been there? You have, Anna.
Yeah.
Is it elitist? Just look at who's there. These guys walking around with their strange trousers, green pants, red jackets, trousers with little whales all over them. The kind of clothes you would wear when you play golf. Do you begin to see the picture here? And of course, everything's overpriced, but we don't mind paying higher prices because we're shopping with the right people. And we make sure we don't have to have our children even brush against the people behind the counter who are the wrong people. We make sure that the people that are selling there are Amish. Am I kidding them? There it is. It's mine. You really have got to go to the marketplace here. Oh, everything's different here. The car you drive becomes part of who you are. And where you get it repaired is part of who you are. And where you go to church is part of who you are. There's a whole stratification system here, especially in Radnor Township. If you're upper class, you go to St. Martin's. It's a cute little church, lovely little church, the elitist little church. As a matter of fact, there are three levels of Episcopal churches in Radnor Township. On Wednesday of next week, I will be in the lower upper class. No, not upper class, lower upper class. We'll be St. David's Church. St. Martin's is upper. You say, are you telling me that even within the Episcopal denomination, it breaks down into class stratification? Of course. When we talk in sociology, we talk about nine classes. Upper, middle upper, lower upper. Upper middle, middle middle, lower middle. Upper lower, middle lower, lower lower. We break it down. And we can tell you the differences. If you're a sociologist, you know all kinds of things. Any of you belong to a church that has a church bus that goes out and picks up kids for Sunday school? I thought you, oh, none of you were really lower class. That is lower class.
Church, we have. Oh, we do.
Yeah. Well, that explains your church, man. You go out and pick up boys and girls.
Absolutely.
We know what kind of church you are. Let me tell you more about your church. I don't know anything about its denomination or anything. Let me tell you more about your church. I'll tell you where the pulpit is located.
All right.
Right in the middle of the platform.
Yes. Well, yes.
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. See, now if you were upper class, you would have a split chancel. As a matter of fact, I know what you call the room that you come through before you get into the sanctuary. It's called the vestibule. If, on the other hand, you're upper class, it's the narthex.
Right.
Incidentally, a friend of mine from Philadelphia married a young woman who was from the Free Church of Scotland, which is anything but free, I assure you. And they are so uptight that you do not kiss the bride at the end of the service. You retreat to the narthex, and you kiss the bride in the narthex. You don't want to create sacrilege in the household of God. But the minister forgot to tell him, because everybody he ever married in the place was always from the right class and understood this. And he said, in the middle of the service, he said, while the choir is singing, he leans over and says, you are to kiss her in the narthex. And he say, what? Kiss her in the narthex. Well, you know what's going through his mind. What are you talking about? You can imagine what he's thinking. And his wife, who starts to giggle, realizing what's happened, saying, he wants you to kiss me in the rear. And he said, they both collapsed in laughter in the middle of the service. Class differentiations. I was in an Episcopal church, a very, very high class Episcopal church in Birmingham, Alabama on Sunday. St. Luke's Episcopal Church to speak. And I didn't speak in the sanctuary. Guess where I spoke? What was the name of the place? I mean, in a low class church, if it's a Pentecostal church, it's the auditorium. You know, if you're middle class, you're into the sanctuary. If you're upper class, you're into what?
The nave.
The nave. I spoke in the nave. It's right. You come through the narthex into the nave. Do you see what I mean? Subcultures have their own language. And if you go from one culture to another culture, you don't even know what they're talking about. As my friend getting married in the Free Church of Scotland will tell you what it's all about. I didn't know what he was talking about. Different languages, different values. It's a vase or a vase. Do you begin to sense there's a whole separate language here, a whole way of pronouncing things? So it's not enough to have the right money. You have to know how to you have to know the language. You have to develop the language. One of the guys that made a fortune on a book, F. Scott Fitzgerald, wrote a book called The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby is a lower class guy who falls in love with this young woman, Daisy, remember? But she is upper. Remember that? So what he does is he goes off to war. They won't let her marry him. And incidentally, she lives right on Long Island Sound. See, it's perfect. I mean, Fitzgerald knows what this is all about. She lives right on Long Island Sound. And the Great Gatsby comes back from the war and goes into bootlegging at the end of World War I during probation, makes a fortune, buys this mansion right across the sound from where Daisy lives, and starts throwing these magnificent parties. And he gets introduced to her. You go and see the movie. The movie's very good. Robert Redford plays the Great Gatsby. And he has learned the language, and he has learned the dress, and he has learned the style. And nobody knows how to handle this. Incidentally, there's a great musical that picks up the class stratification thing 100%, pointing out that you move from one social class to another social class only if you know the language. And what's the movie?
My Fair Lady,
right? I mean, the whole thing is built around taking this girl from the West End and teaching her how to pronounce words. and how to behave in society. I mean, it's a wonderful movie simply because it captures the reality, social class. And so if you're going to be part of the ruling elite, you not only have to have a lot of money, you have to know the style and the problem. When black people get a lot of money, they're rich. They are not wealthy. They still drive into the city and go to the Baptist church. Mayor Nutter, who is now the mayor of Philadelphia, is a member of my church. Great guy. I think he's going to be a great mayor. But do you begin to see a pattern emerging here? When you look at the city and you understand its structure, you've got to say, here's another phrase that you need to know. What is the power structure of the city? What is the power structure of the city? You say, well, the mayor and the... Oh, no, 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 no. The city council, they make the decisions that rule the city. They determine what happens in the city. Guess what? Pittsburgh's in trouble. Economically, it's in trouble. It used to have what I thought was the finest, most active, second most active airport in the country, second only to Chicago. Now it's down the bottom of the list. You can throw a baseball down any one of the corridors and it won't hit anybody. Entire terminals have been closed down because a bunch of U.S. Airways corporate executives decided to move the hub from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia. It was as simple as that. How do you think the mayor felt about it? How do you think the town council felt about it? They knew that this was going to be an economic disaster for the city. What were they able to do about it? Nothing. They couldn't do a thing. It's a free enterprise system. We'll just move it out of here. It's as simple as that. There's unemployment in Pittsburgh today because the steel mills. It was once known as the steels. It still goes by the name. But the steel is over in Japan now. There's massive decisions being made of where steel is going to be produced. When the executives of these steel companies realized that they could produce steel better and cheaper in Japan, what did they do? They moved. Did this affect the city? So don't tell me that the power structure are the people that are elected. What determines the destiny of the city are those who control the economic system. You say, there you go, you sound like a Marxist again. Please argue with me all you want. Is this true or not true about Pittsburgh? Is Pittsburgh in trouble because U.S. Airways have moved out, because the steel companies have moved out? And let me explain why the steel companies moved out. Because during World War II, America bombed into oblivion, Japan. We blew that place apart. And you know what we did? We bombed all the steel mills. We blew them away. The war ended, and the Japanese built brand new steel mills utilizing the most efficient technology. Beautiful news, highly efficient. The technology of World War II, war creates all kinds of technological innovation. The technology had gone way up. Pittsburgh still had the steel mills, but they were steel mills built back in the 20s. They were in no way able to compete. Same with the railroads. Those of you who have been to Europe and have traveled on European railroads, you say, why can't American railroads be like this? Because we built our railroads in the 1910s and 1920s. They are all worn out railroad systems. Europe, fortunately, had their entire railroad system bombed off the map. Their entire railroad system is brand new. Ours is old. Our steel mills are old. Our technology is way behind them. E. Digby Baltzell would give a lecture every year at the University of Pennsylvania. And it was an open lecture, and people always packed into it because it was such an obvious truth that nobody ever paid attention to. He called the lecture Manners and Morals. And he said, if I have to choose between living in a mannerly society or a moral society, I will choose to live in a mannerly society. Now, this was during the 60s, where everybody wanted to be up front. Let it all hang out. We want honesty, you know. We don't want any of this phoniness. And there's one thing you can say about manners. They are incredibly phony. Manners. It's the proper way of addressing people. It's saying, good morning, how are you today? And what you don't want to hear is the truth. You don't want to know what I'm doing today? My daughter's pregnant. My son's freaked out on drugs. You want to know how I am today? You want me to say what? Fine. How are you? Fine. Have a good day. Thank you. I hope you have a good day too. Manners. We don't want truth. We want manners. The students would go ballistic at this point. And he would always say this. Okay. The Adorno studies. We were sociology students, so we all knew the Adorno studies. The Adorno studies done out of the University of Frankfurt, known among sociologists as the Frankfurt School. It was a who's who, just like the University of Chicago was the center of American urban sociology. Frankfurt was the school where neo-Marxists were. Erich Fromm was there. Adorno was there. I mean, it was a virtual who's who of the great Marxist intellectuals of Europe were at the Frankfurt School. And Adorno, during the 1930s, decided to do a study on the kinds of people that become fascist. That's an interesting subject. During the 1930s, you're in Germany. You wanted, who becomes fascist? What is the attraction of fascism? Because it was picking up momentum. The study was brilliant. It's still famous. And the name of the study is the one that you should know. It's called The Authoritarian Personality. What are the kinds of people that submit themselves to authoritarians? This was big stuff at the University of Frankfurt. I mentioned Erich Fromm the other day writing the book, The Escape from Freedom. Same question. Why do people become fascists? Why do they surrender and submit themselves to Hitler? It was a big thing at the University of Frankfurt. In the Adorno studies, he points out, after careful analysis, he came up with indices to evaluate the degree to which people were anti-Semitic. And what he found out was simple. The German people tested extremely anti-Semitic. Do you really need a sociological study to point out that the Germans were anti-Semitic during the 1930s? But here's where the study was really interesting. The same study was done on the British, and it was discovered that the British were more anti-Semitic than the Germans. But there was a difference. The Germans were honest. They hated Jews. They despised Jews. Were they honest about it? Were they upfront about it? Did they let it be known that they despised Jews? As a matter of fact, not only did they despise Jews, but they threw them into concentration camps and threw them into ovens, 6 million of them. Agreed? Were they? Please, I'm not talking about the morality of it. I'm just talking about the forthright honesty of the German people. They weren't phony. Were they phony about it? Did they pretend that they weren't anti-Semitic when they really were? No, they were right up front. In the words of the people in the 60s, they let it all hang out. Now, the British were even more anti-Semitic than the Germans. But there is a difference. The British were mannerly. And even though they disliked Jews, they always treated them as ladies and gentlemen. I guess many of you, if not all of you, went to see that movie, Chariots of Fire. And do you remember this young Jewish athlete, this 100-yard dashman that goes to Oxford University? And he's Jewish. And you remember the King of England does not want to shake hands with him after he wins the 100-yard dash. He's Jewish. I mean, not only, we always talk about Hitler not wanting to shake hands with Jesse Owens wouldn't shake hands with Jesse Owens after he won 4 gold medals at the Olympics. Remember, the King of England refused to shake hands with a Brit who had just won a gold medal in the 100-yard dash and in the 200-yard dash, 100-meter and 200-meter, because he was Jewish. This is scary. See, we don't pay attention to this one. So you were always treated, except when you did something obscene. And this was known all across the world, what happened. It was so unmannerly. But as you noticed in that film at Oxford, they may have disliked Jews, but they always treated this guy with courtesy. They always treated him with courtesy. They may have even discriminated against him, but they always treated him with courtesy. Yes, we're not going to let you in, but we're certainly sorry. We have to do this. And then he would spring the trap. If you were Jewish during the 1930s, where would you rather live? In Germany, where everybody was honest about how they felt? Or in England, where they were dishonest about how they felt and behaved in a mannerly fashion? And he'd look at the audience, which was about half Jewish, and say, take your choice. Where would you rather live? End the debate. Everybody would rather live in England. Even though the English were more anti-Semitic than the Germans, because the Germans were more upfront about it. They were honest about it. They were more moral about it. I hope I don't have to choose between living in a mannerly society or a moral society, but if I have to make a difference, I would choose to live in a mannerly society. And you see this when you begin to travel around this country. The South may be a very immoral place. Racial tensions still run high in places like South Carolina. But the people in South Carolina are mannerly. So when you talk to an African American on the streets of Charleston, he will treat you with politeness. Even if he despises white people, he will treat you with politeness. As a matter of fact, if you're African American and go into a store and the person behind the counter is white, the person behind the counter will treat you with politeness. Even though you're discriminated against race, because we are still mannerly down here. It's still yes, sir, and no, sir. You can always meet children when they grow up in the South. They know how to look at you straight in the eyes and say, Roman, I'd like you to meet my friend, David. How do you do, sir? Do you go to school? No, sir. What's this sir stuff? No, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. What's going on here? Manners. Manners. And as we analyze cities, we have to ask, are they moral or are they mannerly? Now, let me just tell you. The elite always maintains the manners and hence conditions the rest of society. So as the elite breaks down, as it has been doing since the 60s, a city like Philadelphia becomes increasingly unmannerly. Increasingly unmannerly. All we care about in Philadelphia is whether people are doing the right thing. We're a very morally oriented society, but we're not very mannerly. Manners have disappeared from the city because the elite is no longer in control of the system. That's scary. You say, can't you have both? Of course you can have both. And that's what we should work for in the kingdom of God. Because the book of Corinthians, the 13th chapter, says this. And I'm talking about expressing love. Love doth not behave itself unseemly. Loving people are always mannerly people. We have lost our manners. And that would be Baltzell's great theme. I wanted to make that point before we go on to questions, because there were some good questions here. First of all, Josh, David, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering, on a daily basis, how do we take in news sources? Or how do we read newspapers without obsessing over things and becoming sucked into sensationalism?
Let's first of all talk about where news comes from. I talked about television. Let's talk about newspapers. When I was at the University of Pennsylvania, a group of Russian social scientists from Moscow University, from the Soviet Union days, took a tour of the universities of America to see what we were teaching in sociology. It's part of a cultural exchange program. University of Pennsylvania was their last stop before they went back to Russia after this 2-month tour. And so our sociology department met with these sociologists from the University of Moscow. The interesting thing was this. The first question was, we're curious about something, very curious about something. You can pick up a newspaper in Chicago. You can pick up a newspaper in New York. You can pick up a newspaper in Philadelphia. And they all run exactly the same stories with exactly the same photos. And the question was, and? They said, how do you do this when you're not a totalitarian state? I mean, in Russia, every newspaper says the same thing. But then we shoot you if you don't say what we want you to say. You don't put guns to anybody's head, and yet every newspaper reports the story in exactly the same manner, with exactly the same photographs. As you've gone to city, if you're traveling in an airplane, and you pick up a newspaper, you'll see the same photograph and the same story, and at the top it'll say AP, Associated Press, or UP, United Press. You see. What happened was this. In the early days of the newspaper industry, every newspaper had its own reporters. The key of this was that whenever you covered the story, you had like 150 different points of view. When the American War broke out and a ship left with soldiers, with Teddy Roosevelt and company, going to charge up San Juan Hill, there was another ship with just as many people on it, and they were all newspapers reporters. They were there to cover the story. Is there a difference in a society where all your news comes from two sources, the United Press and the Associated Press, two sources, and a system where hundreds of people are covering the newspaper? One of the most interesting things, and Thomas, since you've been to the United Kingdom and probably watched the news, the morning news is very fascinating. Here's what will happen on the morning news in London. Because everybody knows The Guardian is a left-wing paper. Everybody knows that The Times is a right-wing paper. And there are several papers in between representing other political viewpoints. So what will happen is that the newscaster will come in and say, this is what happened yesterday. And he'll describe an event. And then he will say, and he'll hold up The Guardian. This is the way The Guardian reported it. And he'll read a couple of lines from The Guardian. This is the way The Times reported it. This is the way The Ledger reported it. And he'll go down five newspapers. He would do more if he had time, but he'll cover five newspapers. And what you quickly learn is that each of these papers has its own political bias. And what one paper thinks is wonderful, another paper will think is terrible. As a matter of fact, they'll even report it that way. There was a disturbance there was a change that took place. You know, how the words that are used. Oh, and they'll give you, and suddenly you realize, my goodness, it's the same event, but it's reported from different political, ideological points of view. There was a time when that was true in America. But America is so big. The covering the nation, news-wise, is impossible. To put a reporter in every major city in the United States, 300 million people, we're talking about 50 million over there, in a very small area, you can see the problem. A newspaper cannot afford to have, Philadelphia Inquirer cannot afford to have reporters in every single city. Oh, the local news they can cover. But they can't cover national news and can't cover international news very well. They have to all get together and draw their news from two major sources. All the news comes through these two sources, which is why so many young people these days don't read newspapers. And when the Pew Foundation decided to study where people get their news, they found that people under the age of 30 were getting their news from watching The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. On Comedy Central, channel on comedy shows. And Al Gore said it well. Al Gore said, that's probably the way it's always been. The reality is that during the Middle Ages, the only people who could tell the truth about the king was the court jester. He was allowed to get away with it, and everybody laughed, even the king laughed. The last vestige of that mindset was Adolf Hitler, who loved Charlie Chaplin movies. And one particular movie he loved more than ever, it was a movie in which Charlie Chaplin ridicules Hitler. I forgot the name of the movie.
The Great Dictator.
What's that?
The Great Dictator.
The Great Dictator. He loved that movie. About once every month, he would just and sit there and laugh. If anybody other than the court jester had done this, he would have been shot. That was the last vestige of the court jester. But now we see it reemerging now in the Colbert Report and the Jon Stewart Report. The question is, does more truth about what's happening in the world come through comedy than through serious reporting? Now, let me just tell you, it goes a little further than that, David. You got a problem in the White House. You have a newsroom. Suppose you're a reporter and I'm the president, and I don't like the way you're reporting things. Two things are going to happen. Number one, when we have those press conferences, I will look right past you and not call on you to speak, ask a question, because I know you're going to ask one of those terrible, embarrassing questions. Like, what are you going to do now that we know that there were no weapons of mass destruction? I don't want to hear that from you. As a matter of fact, I just don't like the way you, I don't like your values. I don't like your attitudes. Do you see? So I'm going to ignore you. Number one. Number two is, when I send out the call for people to come to the press conference because something very important has just happened, guess who's going to be the last one to get an invitation? Who's going to be the last one there? And all of a sudden you say, hey, everybody's getting the scoops on me. All the other newspapers or reporters are beating me. I had better play ball. And so whoever is in the presidency, and this has nothing to do with Democrat or Republican, whoever's in the presidency has the ability to influence the press in mighty powerful ways. Do you begin to see how news operates? Once again, sociologists would ask this. That little book, News from Nowhere, that I mentioned the other day by Epstein, doesn't pick up newspapers. But there are other places that pick up newspaper studies and analyze them in depth. But all the news comes through just, there are some independent newspapers. And they're not just liberal. The New York Times is independent. And this is why people from one end of the country to the other get the New York Times. There was one other newspaper in New York that was independent. What was it?
The Herald Tribune.
No.
No?
No. The Herald Tribune is Chicago, isn't it?
There's a Tribune in Chicago. Yeah. The Herald Tribune was the international.
No, the one that was independent was the Wall Street Journal. But the Wall Street Journal now has been bought by Murdoch, who owns about half of the newspapers in the United States. And he is extremely conservative. And what he's trying to do is buy the New York Times. Do you see what's going on here? Certain people who have ideological axes to grind did this. What else does Murdoch own?
Australia.
Half of Australia, yeah. No, he owns the Fox networks. Does Fox News have a kind of conservative bias to it? Do you begin to sense there's a difference between CNN and Fox? And you begin to see certain special interest groups controlling huge numbers of newspapers, beginning to take control of the television. Clear Channel is another one. But the point is that at one particular stage, there was legislation that would have allowed the entire television industry to operate under the auspices of one owner. That it was possible to buy one person to buy up all these stations and control the entire television industry. Fortunately, a lot of us got upset when we began to see that emerging and we went ballistic and it was called down. What are the ramifications of monopolies of the television industry? What are the implications of that? I come out with a book, that book, Red Letter Christians. I can tell you which television shows will have me and which won't. I made the Colbert Report. They love the book. Comedy Central. What if Murdoch controls Comedy Central? Might the programming change? The system is increasingly controlled by fewer and fewer and fewer people who are exercising ideological interests on what is reported. I hope that kind of answers your question. Why newspapers are the way they are, and what they report, and how they report it, and the slant that the stories are given, more and more controlled, more and more controlled.